to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 557. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm back with my good, dear friend of a long time, my first internet friend, although we've been friends in person too, Jeff Waddington, who serves in a pastoral capacity, serving as stated supply of Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to talk to you.
Oh, it's good to be back and love serving the saints at Orthodox.
Yeah.
As we like to call it.
I think it's catching on. Orthodox. Presbyterian Church. I love it. Well, I say you're my first internet friend. Of course, I interacted with people online years ago, but we got to know each other through a recommendation from Bill Edgar. I was kind of maintaining a site called solagratia.org. Most people know this. If you've read the introduction or the first chapter to our book, No Uncertain Sound, it's in there.
Right.
But we were looking for people to contribute. And so we just cold called. Well, we really just sent an email just out of the blue to Bill Edgar, who we'd never spoken to, never met before. And he suggested you and Sebastian Heck. And so
both of
you wrote a bit for the website. But that's how I got to know Jeff. And then we became friends and corresponded a bit on the telephone. And then when I visited, I think it was my 2005 visit to Philadelphia.
That long ago?
Yeah,
wow.
I was preparing to move out to attend seminary after a little bit. I had started some independent studies from a distance, but I moved out there to look for apartments. It might have been 06.
I remember.
It was May 07. Now the story keeps changing. Fake news. it would have been, I think it was May 07. Regardless, you picked me up in the van at in front of the Westminster Library. Do you remember where you drove me?
Yeah, to Lane's.
Right.
To Dr. Tipton's house, which I'm still in the habit of doing. In fact, I did it yesterday with another friend, and
that's
we were on the porch.
If anyone comes to visit Jeff, who's somewhat mildly interested in theology, they'll somehow end up on Lane Tipton's porch.
Yep. If I can help it and Lane's available, then that's where we end up.
Well, we're thankful for that. I've learned so much there. And when I kind of, I don't know, you live in the spirit, the zeitgeist of those kinds of conversations today, as we're talking about Pseudo-Dionysius, the Areopagite, everyone's favorite theologian. We're going to be speaking about him as he is related to the work in the theology of Thomas Aquinas, because we're picking up on some of our conference themes and hopefully introducing some of these things to people in advance of our fall 2018 theology conference, which is coming up in October. Last week, we spent quite a bit of time, about an hour and 20 minutes total for the episode, to discuss some of these deeper issues and the deeper Protestant conception, and how Voss, we believe, offers a better and more biblical way forward in terms of the beatific vision. And if you look at in broad strokes, the options that are available for people who are Christians looking at the beatific vision and what that means, you can see a great, Roman Catholic tradition that deals with the beatific vision, and that's largely represented or largely influenced by the work of Thomas Aquinas. But then we also see a mainline position or a modernist position, which, for the sake of our conference, we're focusing a bit on the work of Karl Barth there, because he's rather representative of that. Now, he was opposed to classic liberalism, but we believe that he presented what Van Til called a new modernism. So he's not too far different. Even though he was opposed to classic liberalism, he presents something that, even though it's not precisely liberal, neither is it conservative or traditional either. It's a neo-orthodoxy, even though that term's fallen out. So the question is, if we are opposed to modernism or liberalism, and we're opposed to all forms of that, must we then adopt the Roman Catholic position? And is the Roman Catholic position just a biblical position? That's the question. But we believe that's a false dichotomy. You don't have to choose one or the other. We think there are some issues fraught within the Roman Catholic position that are down to the foundations, down to the core. That has to do with ontology and metaphysics. And so we believe, and we hope to bear this out in our conference and a little bit today, on how Gerhardus Voss offers a biblical position, which is a covenantal position. And it's not merely because we love Voss and we believe he's the answer to everything, but we believe he's exegeting properly. And that's why we're looking to Voss here and what he calls the deeper Protestant conception. So as we begin that, I want to introduce some things for the conference. If people are listening to this episode the day it comes out, which is Friday, August 31st, 2018, then today for you, that day is the last day that early bird registration is open for our fall conference. You can still register into the future, even though tickets are still being sold. There's still quite a few left to the main conference. The VIP dinner is sold out, but the main conference still has plenty of seats. But if you want to register for the lowest available rate, which is just $55 for just general admission for coming for that day, then register now. You need to get on the internet and do that ASAP. The rates will go up, I think, to $65, maybe $70 if you don't make that. Also, I should mention that there's a student rate available. So if you're a college student or seminary student, you know, currently enrolled and taking classes, then we have a rate for $40. So it's a great opportunity to get in and register. We'd love to have you come down to Grays Lake, Illinois, and we'd love to meet you and discuss these things and further develop the arguments that we're presenting both last week and this week, with full documentation. We've got some comments on the website. We're very thankful for the comments, some very helpful comments, but for many people. You know, people are definitely wanting more information. They want names of issues. They want to know specifics. And that stuff needs to come in the proper form. It needs to come in documented addresses with footnotes and whatnot. And so that stuff's coming. But Jeff, I wanted to get you on the horn today, or the video feed here, to discuss your conference topic, which is exceedingly important, but also one that might, to the outsider or to the uninitiate, seem like something rather bizarre, something not just eclectic, but esoteric, where it doesn't seem to have this initial punch. Where how does this apply to me? Jeff, could you introduce to us your subject, and also just in broad strokes, tell us why this really matters?
Sure. I'm going to be addressing the influence, or I should say Thomas Aquinas's use of Dionysius the Areopagite, now known to us as Pseudo-Dionysius, and I'll go into a little bit of that shortly. But the idea is to look at how Thomas draws upon Dionysius, who is one among several sources. He's not the only source he draws upon, but he is very influential on the thinking of Thomas through Thomas's own mentor, Albertus Magnus, or Albert the Great. And it relates to our topic because it provides, I think, the whole background canvas, if you will, on which we then will paint descriptive details, and also ask the question, what does that mean? Why is this important? It's important for at least two reasons. One is to get an accurate understanding of Thomas and his sources. And it's important, I guess, for three reasons. I'm gonna be like the Proverbs and the Psalms, for two reasons, yea, even for three, yea, maybe even for four. And so Thomas is still a major influence in Roman Catholic circles, even in, you know, I guess you would say conservative Roman Catholic circles, but certainly in conservative Catholic circles. And there is there has always been a movement, but especially today, a movement to reappropriate Thomas for today within even Reform circles. And so the question we want to ask is this worth doing? And if it is, or isn't, or if it isn't, then let's be warned. If it is worth doing, how do we do it wisely?
Right. And that can come in a variety of ways, correct? Yeah. I mean, there are some people that are very appreciative of Thomas and read him as historians or historical theologians. There are others who want to engage in a full-blown process of retrieval. I think perhaps that Thomas right. offers the answers to today's contemporary ills, and that we need to, adopt large portions of his systematics or his philosophy even to engage in today. Some people want to use Thomas's theological method.
Right.
We'd have some significant issues with that as well. And then others just are interested in what other people have said. So there's a lot of reasons to read Thomas. I read Thomas.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. But the issue at hand is whether or not Thomas is going to provide us the solid foundation upon which we need to build a classic theism that holds to immutability, that holds to simplicity and those sorts of things. And then where Thomas does affirm those things, not to dig deeper and to see whether there is true congruence with Reformed and biblical theology with Thomas, or whether what we're reading in Thomas is more or less a formal similarity. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, we are always suspicious when we look at, say, the Mormon Church or the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they use traditional Christian language, but they define those words differently. And the truth of the matter is, even going backwards in time in the Christian tradition, specifically of the West, although with Dionysius we're actually delving into the Eastern mm-hmm. Tradition as well, they have been read in some instances as affirming things that we would agree with, but I'm coming slowly but surely to a solidified conclusion that in some instances, certainly not in all instances, but in some and maybe in many instances, this understanding of the concepts that are being retrieved from Thomas and Dionysius by way of Thomas are in fact not consistent with biblical Reformed confessional Christianity.
Right. That's quite helpful. Let's back up then and see why.
Sure.
Why are we speaking then about Dionysius? How does he relate to Thomas? I think a lot of people can understand how Thomas fits in. He's an enormous figure, with enormous influence upon the Christian church. But why Dionysius, and who's Dionysius, who's pseudo-Dionysius, and what's it mean for him to be an Areopagite?
Right. The reason that I wanted to look at Dionysius is simply because he's the second or third most cited authority in Thomas, in the Summa Theologiae. You have the Bible, so you have the scriptures, then you have Aristotle, Augustine, and Dionysius. I believe that's probably the order of the citations. Going back, Dionysius the Areopagite was a member of the Areopagus that met with the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 17, the famous Mars Hill address.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the few that responded favorably to Paul's interrupted address. You remember he wasn't able to complete that. As soon as he mentioned the resurrection, that got the hackles up. But Dionysius was one who responded favorably. So Thomas understands the Dionysius that we will be talking about as the convert of the Apostle Paul. That's what he understands. That's who he understands Dionysius to be, the actual mm-hmm. convert of Paul. And therefore, he is given a theological weight commensurate with that reality. Thomas very clearly distinguishes in the Summa Theologiae between the different levels of authority. Scripture is in a category all by itself.
Rightly so.
For Thomas, mm-hmm. Yes. And then you have doctors of the church. They are a lesser authority, but still authoritative, and that's where Dionysius fits in for Thomas. And then you have pagan philosophers who come after that in terms of authority. Dionysius, the real Dionysius, or I should say the author of the works that are attributed to Dionysius, now known as Pseudo-Dionysius, was probably late 5th, early 6th century monk, probably from Syria, although again, some of this is extrapolating from the text that we do have by attributed to Dionysius. It was first, there were actually early church fathers, I should say later, church fathers in the East who were beginning to question whether Dionysius of the writings was the real Dionysius from Acts 17. But it was under Lorenzo Valla and John Grosius in the 1400s and 1500s who called the legitimacy of that attribution into question. You may remember Lorenzo Valla is the same one who revealed that Constantine's donation was a forgery. And then Erasmus of Rotterdam, Desiderius Erasmus, makes that questioning of Dionysius's identity commonly known. So it gets out there in the world. And today you will find Roman Catholic scholars of Thomas who will readily grant that the Dionysius who wrote these texts is not the Dionysius who was a convert of Paul in Athens, as recorded in Acts 17. But Thomas did think he was.
Yeah.
So that we need to remember that in terms of how Thomas handles him
mm-hmm.
as an authority.
Now, what types of theological concepts or topics does he lean on Dionysius the most? Do we find him throughout his works? Is it a particular subject matter?
Throughout his works, in using Dionysius, again, he's one of several, many sources, Augustine being another, and of course Aristotle, and the Neoplatonic philosophical tradition as a whole, which is somewhat of that tradition is rather amorphous. It's kind of like silly putty. I was going to say Plato, but then you might confuse Plato with Plato. Seeing if you're awake, you can study the history of Neoplatonic philosophy, which is a revisiting of Plato. But the Neoplatonic philosophy is an amalgam of different writers, and there'll be various and sundry contributors. Neoplatonic philosophy usually is traced back to Plotinus and Proclus, his disciple. And Proclus is the one who many think Dionysius builds upon in particular. If you're interested in getting a kind of a brief summary, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that's available online, you can read a very helpful entry on both Dionysius and on Neoplatonic philosophy. And you'll see there that Neoplatonic philosophy has a religious element, and that's not something written by, as far as I know, by a Christian or by a Reformed Christian. That's an assessment of a secular Neoplatonic philosopher. So Dionysius builds on that Neoplatonic strain of philosophy, and it does appear to me to be something different from discovering common grace truth. And I'll have more to say about that in the address. It appears to be that Dionysius, like Thomas after him, is endeavoring to blend the best of Neoplatonic philosophy with Christian theology.
I see.
And Thomas, of course, as you know, seeks to do something like that with Aristotle.
Yeah.
And Aristotle, by the way, is not in disagreement with Neoplatonism in many instances. He is absorbed into that bloodstream of Neoplatonic thinking. And that's what Dionysius is building on, more the Neoplatonic than Aristotelian, because there's historical issues of when were the works of Aristotle discovered, when are they translated, by what route do they come to Western Christendom. Aristotle in many ways was introduced, or certain works of his were introduced, by way of Muslim philosophers, yeah, or the influence of Muslim philosophers, certainly with Thomas.
Yeah.
So the if you understand, Neoplatonism is the basic idea that you have one, various in the Christian Neoplatonic tradition, he would be identified as God, but the one cannot be described, is beyond description. We'd say ineffable. And the one creates apparently unaware that it is creating. And that's why often the metaphor that is used of the relationship of the one to the rest of creation is a waterfall, or a fountain, be more accurate. If you think of a water fountain, it usually spills over. The water spills over from the spout and falls down upon various levels or layers before it reaches the bottom where the water mm-hmm. is caught. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a water fountain. And that is often how creation is understood. The one creates not as an act of will, in other words, not as a choice, but it just happens. And in some instances, that is understood that the one doesn't know that it is, and yeah. I'm specifically using the word it and not he.
Well, that's something that we find in like a proto-Gnosticism, isn't it? Like what Paul was addressing in Colossians, in large measure, is this idea of a pleroma, or the fullness.
Right.
And then that fullness, that being, whatever it is, whether it's conscious or not, overflows, and the overflow proceeds to create, or you know, generate in some way a cascading of beings that right. are that descend from the one closest to the pleroma, to God, all the way down to the bottom of the chain of being, which is always cats.
Or prime matter in particular.
Oh, man.
The expression used.
Prime matter.
Prime matter.
Then cats.
Prime matter with prime matter. Yeah, well, okay. Prime matter is unformed matter. You don't like cats, I gather. You're putting them at the bottom of the chain
close.
Of being.
Right. Cats, yeah. Packer fans.
Wow. Okay. Well, I was going to say New York Yankees.
We could fit them in there too.
We could put anything we don't like at the bottom of the chain of being.
Now, this is a project of retrieval. I like this project of retrieval.
This project of retrieval.
Well, I mean, to be serious, though, there's in some way a chain of being. And so
yes.
What Paul is addressing in Colossians is this idea that Christ and others is the greatest of, well, maybe Jesus is the greatest of the overflow, but he's not God. And so he rejects that fully. So he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, not in the sense that he's firstborn, he's prototokos, he's chief, meaning he equates Christ with God because Jesus is God. That's not an idea completely unrelated from the subject when we're talking pseudo-Dionysius or Thomas on ontology, for example. Because there's always been this problem in philosophy, trying to relate all things that exist and how do they square with one another. And that's a big question, because some people would say, you know, or let me ask you this question. God exists. That's true. Humans exist. That's true. So are we just a lesser form of God? That's a big issue. And then also, if we are to be glorified one day and to experience the beatific vision, consummate union and communion with God, what does that mean for our being, for our essence, and how does it relate to God's essence? Those are the issues on right. the table. That's what we're speaking about.
Now, some of these things post-date Dionysius, and some of them post-date Thomas as well. But Dionysius is intending to be orthodox, as is Thomas. Okay, so we want to be clear that they say things that they think or they intend to guard against confusion with pagan philosophy. But the question, of course, is do they do that sufficiently or sufficiently well? Because there is we recognize again the idea of there being common grace truth in even right. pagan thought, but in this instance truth in compromised Christian thought.
Right, we could say borrowed capital, and whether it's right. properly borrowed or is it
right.
co-opted and wasn't stolen to begin with.
Right. Well, there's kind of a dialectic going on there. Or a back and forth, if you will, with regard to our relationship to the world and the truth that God reveals of himself in nature and in scripture, but we're thinking in terms of nature or natural revelation, I guess, if you want to include philosophy in that. And that's a whole nother question, right?
Yeah, big question.
Clearly Dionysius does. Dionysius, when he wants to fill out the picture of this, the idea is of being or existence is equated with the good. And again, this would go back to Plato. So this would go back to the earliest stages of the development of Greek philosophy. And why that's important to note is the good, by definition, diffuses itself. Okay, you understand the insignificance of that statement.
Well, explain it. What does it mean that the good diffuses itself?
Communicates itself. Okay, in other words, again, it's related to this fountain, this water fountain spilling over without the intent of spilling over. So the good... if the one is the good, and that would certainly be Dionysius' perspective, then the definition of creation is the diffusion of the good, of goodness,
mm-hmm.
down to other levels of being. Now, Dionysius. His understanding of how we know about God is related to the nature of the one being simple, right? We know about God through what's called the triplex via, or the threefold way.
Mm-hmm.
Way of negation, or sometimes called remotion, way of immanence, and then the way of causality. That's the threefold way, and Thomas picks up on that from Dionysius. So Dionysius is a big apophatic theologian, theologian of the negation.
Yeah.
Okay. Cataphatic is affirmation. Apophatic is negation. So it's we know about God, or we come to learn about God by way of negating, because we know about God from creatures, from the ground up, so to speak. And so he has the threefold way with from what I have been able to read in Dionysius's works, which is all of them. First, you have to be able to figure out what he's saying and then determine whether you agree with what he's saying. But 99% of it is figuring out what he's saying. But anyway, so for Dionysius, the one or the Christian view of Christian God, and between the Christian God and the layperson are levels of being, gradations of being, mm-hmm. including nine choirs of angels, also including the ecclesiastical hierarchy. In his case, Eastern Orthodoxy, not Roman Catholicism per se, but you have the hierarch, which is the bishop, then you have the priest, the monk, the nun, and then the layperson, basically. And those are levels of gradation, and the higher up the ecclesiastical hierarchy, the closer you get to God. Mm. And the Christian life is thought of in terms of an ascent to God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dionysius is one of his favorite pictures of this ascent. And remember, you can't know anything about God in the sense of affirmation, or very little. Although I would argue that there is inconsistency here, because he does grant that the scriptures are a revelation from God. The picture that is used is one from Moses ascending Mount Sinai into the black clouds, when Moses is given the law at Sinai. That is the picture that Thomas will also pick up on. Okay. And Dionysius sees himself as part of the chain of being. He has a mentor. His name is Hierotheus, and he has a disciple whose name is Timotheus. And so the share, the passing along of theology is a part of, works along the chain of being. I mentioned the illustration of Moses going into the dark cloud because Dionysius is very much a mystic.
Yeah,
the cloud of unknowing.
These two ideas or these thoughts are very congruent. They fit well with one another. The mysticism and the, you know, an ascent of being seem to serve one another well.
Now, Augustine talked about the Christian life as one of ascent, an increase in wisdom. So there's, you know, we could say, well, insofar as we are being conformed to the image of Christ, that's what they mean by ascent. But I think there's more to it than that, although they would say that that's part of what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, related to the chain of being and the various levels of being is what we call participation.
Ooh, that's the big word. That's the word of the year for me. I've been searching high and low. Now, I don't want a participation trophy. That's not what I'm talking about. But we're searching high and low for not just a definition, but one that seems to actually mean something. But it's hard to find a definition on participation here, speaking ontologically or metaphysically.
Oh, it's terrible.
And then when you find it, it seems to be kind of a tautological thing.
Yes, it's now if you already are on track with this whole idea of the chain of being, and this is ontological as far as I can see. For Dionysius, it's an ontological chain. You know, different levels of being from God down to something like prime matter, which is what it would be called in Neoplatonic philosophy. For Dionysius, I just lost my train of thought.
Talking about participation.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The various levels of being, you have being. God is being itself. Okay, the rest of creation, the rest of the picture, exists according to levels of being by participation in the one, in God's being, sharing. Okay, another word for participation would be sharing in the being of God. To a lesser extent, of course, in a limited way. Those higher on the ladder of being having greater share in God's being or existence, and those on the lower end having less. Cats.
Right.
And
you're learning. You're there.
Yes.
Timotheus.
Timotheus. Hierotheus has a higher level of being. So that's in a nutshell. That's Dionysius. Thomas is now remember that Dionysius is in the air in medieval Christendom. Not only he's first cited by a church theologian in the early 500s, like around 514, 518, somewhere in that neighborhood. And that's how we ascertain when these things were really written, as opposed to being written by Dionysius, the disciple of Paul.
I see.
So they're first cited in the 500s, early 500s. It then becomes common. This is for us, it's a new thing that many of us have never heard of, but in Thomas's day, which is the 1200s, so there's 700 years that separate Dionysius from Thomas. That's almost as many years as separates Thomas from us.
Sure, it's much further away than we are from the Reformation, just to put a perspective on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Dionysius is in the air. This is a common source of Catholic theology. He is a major source that is drawn upon by all sorts of people who interact with him in many different ways, accepting this element, rejecting that element, and so on. And you're going to discover an eclecticism, and of course leads to the question, what is your criteria for accepting one thing and rejecting another? But that, be that as it may, that's how it works. So Thomas's mentor, Albert Magnus, or Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, or Albert the Great, wrote commentaries on various works of Dionysius. And I should mention Dionysius is what we have currently available, and everything that is available is on the web. Or in the early church fathers, the Anti-Nicene Fathers set.
Right.
Portion, the first third. It's in there. And you can read some of this and give yourself a headache. Not only because it's in a different world. It's a different universe of discourse.
Yeah.
And so you have the one book that is written, is commented on frequently, is on divine names. That is how we name God. And then there is the mystical theology. There are letters that Dionysius wrote to various individuals. We have some of those. Then we have the celestial hierarchy. That's dealing with the nine choirs of angels that I spoke about earlier. And then you have the ecclesiastical hierarchy, which is dealing with the hierarchy as it's reflected in the liturgy and government of the church. So that's Dionysius. Now Thomas learns Dionysius through the teaching and influence of his mentor Albert the Great. And Thomas himself will write a commentary on the divine names, which actually is, unlike the book that on divine names, is actually quite clear in how he describes it. So Thomas picks up on these things. Thomas will disagree in a quite significant way with regard to the nature of the mysticism, whereas for Dionysius it really is really apophatic theology. It is Nicholas of Cutes will later refer to in his own teaching as learned ignorance, a docta ignorantia. But in Thomas will disagree. His understanding of mysticism, he can't get past the doctrinal teaching of the scriptures and the confessions and creeds of the church, whereas Dionysius tends to pass over those things or to give them short shrift. Thomas his view. So Thomas differs substantially, pardon the pun, at that particular point with Dionysius. Yeah. But Thomas builds on the chain of being notion. The doctrine of analogy in Thomas is a big thing, and Thomas and analogy is a cottage industry in the publishing sphere, going back to the Middle Ages, Cardinal Cajetan. This is the same Cardinal Thomas de Wio, who met with Martin Luther in Germany and tried to get Luther to recant. This is before the Diet of Worms. This is the one where Thomas comes and his Dr. Vatrish, tells him, behave yourself, be kind, be obsequious, that kind of thing. And Luther tries to be, but then he just can't contain himself. And this gets into disputes with Cardinal Cajetan. Well, Cajetan was considered in his day one of the most significant commentators on Thomas, and he wrote a book on the analogy of names. Now, that particular book has been understood to be a commentary on Thomas, but actually it's actually a commentary on the idea of analogy, broadly speaking. But so commentators on Thomas go back further back than that. There are so many books. I had at one point 30 books on Thomas and analogy in my library.
Wow. Wow.
And that was just barely scraping the surface. Mm-hmm. So Thomas builds on and differs in significant ways from Dionysius, but Thomas's view of God and the Christian life is one of man is created. I don't want to give too much away. We want to have something left to actually say at the conference, Adam is created when the soul and the body are brought together in the first man, there are appetites in the body that tend to pull down the soul, the intellectual appetites, the will and the intellect in particular.
It's concupiscence, correct?
It's known as concupiscence. Now, that's going to be a major disagreement between the reformers and the reformed after them and Roman Catholicism. So Thomas has built in the notion that man is already tending toward nothing or tending toward non-existence.
Right.
Non-being. In regard to his doctrine of concupiscence. We would say, no, what you've just done is said that man is created with a sinful nature.
Well,
from
right.
From the beginning.
And the Catholics,
that's not how they would understand it.
Right. Right. Catholics would reject that entirely. They would say that concupiscence tends towards sin, but it is not sin itself. We were talking about this before. And then a Catholic might respond to us and say, well, what accounts for the fall then? If man was created morally upright, how did he fall? It is a mystery. But they would say, well, then why not to place the mystery in concupiscence? That's a question for another day. But I would encourage people to go back and listen particularly to Lane Tipton's comments in our last episode, Christ the Center 556, because this is one of the most important points regarding Thomas and his doctrine of the beatific vision. But it's not just the doctrine of the beatific vision. It has to do with everything he's doing in terms of his ontology and metaphysic. Who is man? And we see at the very beginning of our anthropology, we have to depart from Thomas, because Thomas has a very completely different notion of the image of God that can in no way account for covenantal theology. It can in no way account for soteriology, the imputation of Christ's obedience unto us. The image of God concept is entirely different. And if the image of God concept is entirely different by nature, or by, pardon the pun, but the implication of that is that everything else having to do with man, whether that's doctrine of sin, doctrine of salvation, the beatific vision, glorification, and Christology, you name it, all of them have something fundamentally wrong with them, within them. We might find many formal similarities and good things in the theology, but we need to understand that the way Thomas develops them is developing them from these initial first principles.
Right. So the question for me would be, seeing as Thomas is using concepts drawn from Aristotle and from the broader Neoplatonic tradition, how far is he distinguishing from that when he uses the concepts drawn from them? And I know he does rework very often and attempts to rework the concepts in a Christian way, but the question becomes, how successful is he in doing that? So we're not talking about his intent. We are talking about his execution. That is, how well he does this. How well does he? And I think he's got the goal, or at least it seems to be, because of his, try to do this in order. So man is created in a state of nature with a problem that's called concupiscence. In order to address that problem, Roman Catholicism has, and Thomas in particular, has dealt with what's called the donum superadditum, or the superadded gift. And it's the superadded gift that enables Adam to function properly and also to eventually see God in the beatific vision. Because while man is created with a pointing in the direction of God, in his natural state, he is not able to reach God. You see, and that's what Lane touched upon last week with regard to the covenant of works. The fact that man is created according to Scripture and according to the Reformed tradition in a covenant with God.
Yeah.
That doesn't require this superadded gift.
You need salvation before the fall, practically. Correct. That's a simplistic way we would term that.
But and so what happens in the fall is the donum is lost. The superadded gift is lost, but the natural the Adam is in his natural state is left untouched.
Right, which is how his intellect or how his reasoning, whatnot, is unaffected. And that leads us into all sorts of other apologetic discussions on method, which is another discussion for another day. But this is why Van Til talks so much about Thomas, because in the Roman Catholic scheme, the fall has no legitimate, no real effect in darkening the understanding, causing unbelievers to suppress the truth and unrighteousness. There's no real consequence to these things. The fall just means that you don't have the donum superadditum, but your reasoning functions correctly. And therefore, a classical apologetic is perfectly warranted if the person has no incapacitation or they have no agenda against God.
Correct. So what we see is that the Christian life, or what we call salvation, for Thomas is the restoration of the lost donum superadditum, which culminates in the beatific vision where the glorified saint sees the essence of God with his spiritual intellect. The glorified saint does.
That's the beholding.
So the Christian life, the Christian pilgrimage, is one of closing the gap, if you will, between Adam as he's created and the glorified saint. In order to be able to see God in his essence, there needs to be what is called the reproportioning of his being.
Mm-hmm. Is this somewhat vaguely similar to what we've seen in more contemporary philosophies as a program of self-actualization? In a way, we just need to actualize our potential. And our potential is to behold and participate in a greater way in the divine essence. And therefore, life is merely the process of ascending that chain and becoming more like God. That's the question. Like, or is it in some way just becoming God, perhaps partially?
Well, Thomas will certainly say that that God and man, the glorified saint, are not merged.
Clearly, yes, we absolutely
terms of his affirmations, he will distinguish between God and the glorified saint. The question is whether the conceptual system and tools that he develops don't lead toward a pantheistic or panentheistic.
Right, and that brings me back to the question I raised earlier when you were talking about participation. And for me, that I earnestly desire further conversation on this with Thomistic scholars. We've been reading a lot of primary literature. By we, I mean the people participating in this conference coming up in a few weeks. Some of the books that I've enjoyed the most have been written by people like Dario Spezzano, Dominique Legge. I want to say Legge because of my German background, but it might be just Leg, as you say, Jeff. Reading a book by Hans Boersma now called Seeing God, same title as our conference, even though we titled our conference before the book was published. And there's several others. There's just, I don't have them in front of me, but particularly Spezzano and Legge.
Yes.
Are very forthright in speaking about how the beatific vision in their reading of Thomas, and these are no lightweights, these are not Thomistic pushovers. The Legge teaches at the Dominican Institute across the street from Catholic University of America. He's at the foremost institution, maybe in the English-speaking world, on this subject, certainly in the United States. And he is very forthright and clear in saying that in the beatific vision, we participate in the divine essence. For me, the big question then is, how is participation different from subsistence? Because the hypostases, Father, Son, and Spirit, subsist in the divine essence. The beatified saint participates in the divine essence. They're very different. They have to be. Thomas affirms a creator-creature distinction. He doesn't want to say that we just become God. He clearly qualifies that. But I've yet to find a real significant treatment of this. People will say it's participation by likeness. But then we're always left with the question of wanting more. And maybe it's not something that we can have more of. We it might be a mysterious thing to say, because I wholeheartedly believe that we are conformed into the image of the resurrected Christ, that we are glorified, and by that we have a greater likeness to God. And so there's a greater similarity, but it's a similarity by covenantal analogy. Right? It's not a subsistence in the divine essence that way, because God is God and we are always creatures. We don't subsist in the essence. But is it a participation? Well, I don't have a covenantal category for that. Should I? Maybe. Maybe that's what we need to develop. But that, to me, is really the kernel of the issue here. I mean, obviously, we've had these conversations before, but where are you at with this conundrum today, Jeff? What have you found in Dionysius and Thomas?
Nothing to alleviate my quandary. And even the exceptionally gifted expositors of Thomas and Dionysius. And I should note, I have right at my feet here 4 books, and I have a few dissertations on Thomas and Dionysius as well that are PDFs.
Do you have the Feingold book? That's another one I was thinking of.
Lawrence Feingold, in fact.
I'm working on that one right now. Yeah.
I'll even show the people so they know what to look for.
Behold the book.
That's the book, Lawrence Feingold's book. See, the natural desire to see God according to St. Thomas Aquinas and his interpreters.
He's a real deal.
This is in the same series as the Dario Spazzano book on the glory of God's grace.
I love that one.
Mm-hmm. So they're very, very, and they don't have a dog in this race in the sense of Protestants appropriating Thomas.
Oh, right. And that
they're not on their radar.
Well, it might ruffle some feathers, but I think that they can read Thomas as Thomas. They don't have to try to, you know, make him sow the seeds for the Protestant Reformation, which in maybe Thomas kickstarted some of those things. I question that, but I've found reading these figures tremendously refreshing because they see where Thomas's theology is heading, and they run toward it with joy.
Yeah.
They write without fear or hesitation. Whereas when you find many Protestants writing, they say, we love Thomas on this, but whoa, we can't follow him here on beatific vision. And I want to say, well, why not? If Thomas is such a genius and he's an intellectual, theological heavyweight, philosophical heavyweight, which I believe he fully is, he's a tremendous mind, then how is Thomas going to have large portions of his corpus entirely unrelated from other portions?
He is like Barthes in the 20th century. Thomas is one of the most, if not the most, systematic theologian that I've come across. And it doesn't mean I like or agree with his theology, but I will tell you that it is an aesthetically pleasing experience to read, because you can track how the various different loci of his theology relate.
Yeah,
I didn't mention it, but
he's integrated.
Yeah, Thomas is an empiricist. We can't know God directly except for the glorified saint. In this life, we can only know God from his effects in creation. So it's a very empirical approach, very Aristotelian at that point, right? And there are all sorts of things that follow from that limitation. And I will add, it is my opinion that both Dionysius and Thomas, and perhaps in slightly different ways, sacred scripture is recognized to be the very word of God without error and true in all that it teaches. And yet the scriptures seem to be absorbed into the larger philosophical framework that is being used to further the Christian faith. And so that's another question. So at the end of the day, we have to ask the question, beyond the historical one, how, you know, if there are elements to be used in contemporary thought, and I'm not going to say that there's nothing that can be learned from either Dionysius, Pseudo-Dionysius, or Thomas, but there needs to be a set of criteria by which we can determine what is useful and what is not, and to say, well, it's the Christian faith. Well, okay. Well, then we have to ask the question: have either of these two theologians adequately evaluated and sifted the tradition upon which they are building, in using the scriptures and the Christian faith, the creeds and the confessions, etc., and theologians from the past? Have they done enough sifting? And I would suggest they have not. And in part of my presentation will actually be to offer a way to evaluate whether it be pagan philosophers or contemporary non-believers or anybody. Hopefully at the end of that address I will speak to that topic.
Oh, I look forward to that. That's probably a good place to hit pause or to stop for the day. But I hope it's been a good introduction. I've tremendously enjoyed my conversation with you today, Jeff, and learned a ton. But, it's a significant issue. How do we relate to God? And 1 John 3:2 says, when we see him, we will be like him. Speaking of the return of our Lord, there will be a glorious resurrection. Peter says in 2 Peter 1:4 that we become partakers of the divine nature. Now, I believe that has to do with sanctification and escaping the corruption that is in the world because of sin, because that's the next phrase in that same sentence. But it's a tremendous issue that we need to wrestle with as Christians. What does it mean to be glorified, to be beatified, to become like the risen Christ? And how do we describe that? What does the Bible say? And then what are we permitted to say as a good and necessary consequence from Scripture? That's what we're trying to do with our conference, seeing God, you know, the deeper Protestant conception. Because we think that there's a proper biblical, and we're Protestants because we hold to the Bible, and we're Reformed for the very same reason. But we believe that the Protestant, Reformed, and Vossian answer to that question is rather strikingly different from the Bardian or the Thomistic or the Pseudo-Dionysian or the Ranarian or the von Balthasarian or whatever. Yes. And so we're not forced to choose one error because it's a little bit less bad than another error. But we believe the Bible gives us the right answers. And so we want to encourage people to go that way rather than to settle for something else or to latch onto something we haven't thought about very much merely because it appears that it might solve a problem with another theologian. It's like The people that became Bardians because they didn't like the liberals. It might help you on a couple battles, but in the long run, it's not going to be good for you. So anyway, that's enough of my preaching. But we encourage you to visit us online. If you head on over to reformedforum.org, and you'll see right on the homepage, there is a big banner for the conference. You can click on that. You can also go under the events menu at the top of the webpage. And there's plenty of information here about the speakers and subjects. There's a schedule of events. But come and visit us October 5th through 7th. The VIP dinner is the night of the 5th. If you're not coming to that, come on the main conference starts on the 6th. It's a Saturday. And you can still register. Early bird rates are still in effect for this very day. August 31st, 2018 is the last day for early bird registration here. So if you're listening to this, head on over to reformedforum.org. Click the register button. That'll take you to Eventbrite, and you can register right there, and we'll get you locked in. We would really love to meet you, to talk to you. And if you have questions, I'm sure you do. I hope you do. If you have a rebuttal, if you're saying you're way off base, you guys haven't thought about X, Y, or Z, or you should read this, we want to hear that. You can comment on the website. Better yet, you come in person. We can sit down and have a cup of coffee or eat a meal together, and we could talk deeply about these things and come through mutual understanding and conversation. And appeal to the Scriptures, come to understand our Savior more deeply. That would be my hope. So, Jeff, we'll look forward to that, won't we?
Yes, much so.
Head on over to the website, reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.